From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Mercer Ellington, who died yesterday at the age of 76. He was the only son of Duke Ellington and spent much of his life working in various capacities for the Ellington Orchestra. Mercer took over the orchestra after his father's death in 1974. We'll hear a 1989 interview. Also today, interviews with the stars of the new film comedy Mr. Wrong, Ellen DeGeneres, star of the sitcom Ellen, and Bill Pullman, co-star of The Last Seduction, Casper, and While You Were Sleeping. And Stephen Schiff reviews Broken Arrow, the new action film directed by John Woo, starring John Travolta and Christian Slater. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. An explosion rocked East London a few hours ago. Details are still sketchy, but witnesses report large number of emergency vehicles around the Canary Wharf Tower. That is Europe's tallest office building and contains several banks and newspaper offices. Moments before the blast, the Irish Republicans' RTE television and radio network in Dublin says it received a statement saying the Irish Republican Army is ending its ceasefire. However, Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, says it knows nothing about any such plans. A judge has ordered murder suspect John DuPont held for trial on murder charges in Pennsylvania. From member station WHYY in Philadelphia, Robbie Harris reports.
The only person who testified at this morning's preliminary hearing for John DuPont was Nancy Schultz, widow of the Olympic wrestler DuPont is accused of murdering. Before a packed courtroom, Schultz testified that on January 26th, she heard three shots from her house on the grounds of DuPont's estate. She said she did not see who fired the first two, but came out of her house in time to see DuPont fire a third shot into her husband's back as he lay face down in the snow. She told the judge she ran inside to call police, and when she returned, DuPont pointed his gun at her. Defense attorneys did not request bail, and none was granted. Court officials say they will likely order a competency hearing for DuPont. For National Public Radio, I'm Robbie Harris in Philadelphia.
The sun is out today over the Pacific Northwest, giving the first hope in days that the massive flooding is coming to an end. Tom Bonsi reports from Olympia, Washington.
Rising floodwaters have forced thousands of residents to flee their homes across Oregon, Washington State, and Idaho. While the skies are clearing now, major rivers, including the mighty Columbia, are still rising after 5 days of relentless rain. Washington State Emergency Management Director Linda Ramsey says today may be the last bad day. Currently, she says the biggest problem is finding sandbags.
We are trying to get sandbags from outside the state. I think we've used up all of the state supply, all of the U.S. Army Corps supply, because Oregon is in worse shape than we are. And we're trying to and are currently bringing in sandbags from as far east as Pennsylvania.
Floodwaters have contaminated some water supplies, leading city officials to urge residents to conserve and to boil tap water before drinking it. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
A federal investigation is underway into the collision of two commuter trains in Secaucus, New Jersey, during this morning's rush hour. Three people were killed and more than 200 injured in the collision. New Jersey Transit authorities say it appears as if one train ran through a stop signal. The black boxes from both the trains have been recovered. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up about 10 points at this hour. This is NPR News. President Clinton says a provision requiring that military personnel with AIDS be discharged is unconstitutional. The provision is part of the 1996 Defense Authorization Bill, which the president plans to sign tomorrow. But the White House says the president has ordered the Justice Department not to defend that provision when it is challenged in court. And administration officials say military personnel who have tested positive for HIV may be allowed to retain their jobs during the court battle. The National Football League approved the move of the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore today in a deal which appears to have satisfied almost everyone. George Hoffman has more from Chicago.
League owners voted 25-2 with three abstentions to allow Art Modell to move his team from Cleveland to Baltimore for the start of next season. However, the team's nickname, the Browns, and its colors and tradition will remain in Cleveland. The deal was considered fair by Cleveland Mayor Michael White, whose city was guaranteed a new or existing franchise by 1999, including help by the NFL to subsidize a new stadium. Art Modell, who has owned the former Browns franchise for 35 years, assailed politicians and the media for their roles in the relocation of his franchise, which likely will be named the Mustangs. The Buffalo Bills and Pittsburgh Steelers voted against the move. Buffalo owner Ralph Wilson stated his opposition to the league loaning the city of Cleveland up to $48 million for its new stadium, a loan the new owner of the team will have to repay. For National Public Radio, I'm George Hoffman in Chicago.
Officials in Sonoma County, California, have issued a health warning urging people not to eat any wild mushrooms. That after a migrant field worker died after eating poison mushrooms. The so-called death caps also sickened a 13-year-old girl and her family. The teenage girl received an emergency liver graft yesterday. Doctors say her liver absorbed most of the poison. She's in serious but stable condition. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we remember Mercer Ellington, who died yesterday at the age of 76 of heart failure. He was Duke Ellington's only son and had conducted the Ellington Orchestra since Duke's death in 1974. Mercer spent much of his life working with the orchestra. As a young man, he was the gopher. In 1950, he briefly played with the orchestra, and in 1964, he became the road manager. Mercer also wrote several compositions that became part of the orchestra's repertoire, including Blue Serge, Jumpin' Pumpkins, and Things Ain't What They Used to Be, which became a jazz standard. Duke Ellington first recorded it in 1941 and often used it as a sign-off theme. In a moment, we'll hear a 1989 interview with Mercer Ellington, recorded after the release of an album which featured his extended composition, Music Is My Mistress, which was also the name of his father's memoir. First, let's hear Duke Ellington performing Mercer's best-known composition at a 1944 Carnegie Hall concert.
We continue with Things Ain't What They Used to Be.
Mr. Ellington, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure being here, Terry.
I was wondering if in any way your father's death liberated you as a composer.
Well, in a sense, it allowed us. In fact, you would think that it would have. But that's not true, really. I mean, I'm under the same restriction as far as competition is concerned. Competition with myself, early Mercer Ellington, and competition, with Duke Ellington, with the same problem he had. The things that he's written are so perennial that all our audiences request many of the tunes from the past, and they have such a great warmth and a great charm that you have to do them. And, you know, can you imagine us doing a concert, say, without playing Satin Doll or Mood Indigo or Sophisticated Ladies?
When your father was alive and you wrote a composition, something like, say, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, would he listen to it and then critique it for you?
No. In fact, it was funny you should pick that particular tune because he called me up. He knew I was out in the street playing around. And he laid for me. He had the clerk in the hotel to give him a ring when I came in, which is about 4:30. And I had been complaining because I wasn't getting the opportunity to write anything and do anything about it. So he waited. And at 4:30, he called me. He says, we have a session at 9 o'clock. I want you to do a side for me. I just reached for everything and anything I could find and threw it out there at him. And I've been trying to write like that ever since.
What was his reaction to it when he heard it?
His reaction was always, his compliment was always silence. His negative reaction was a suggestion. Well, you might have done this, or do you think this is possible, or whatever. And much as it was the case with him as an individual, to bring him to a point of decision or to make it, get him to make an absolute statement called for a certain kind of treatment that you had to give him. I'd be in the dither as to how to get from one town to the other, whether to charter the bus, whether we should fly or take the train. If I asked him what should I take, I'd never get an answer. So my way of invoking a decision from him would be, well, Pop, tomorrow we're going to get up at 9 o'clock and take the train out to Philadelphia. And he'd say, well, what's wrong with the airplane? Then I knew we could fly.
Was it understood when your father was getting older that you would take over the band after he died?
Absolutely not. I mean, it never occurred to him. It never occurred to me. Only thing, if it had occurred to me, I would have studied piano much more seriously than I did. But all I cared about was getting into the orchestra. And I knew if I played piano, that wouldn't happen.
You played in the Ellington Band, didn't
yes.
you? How long did you play?
I was with them for 1 year in 1950 and left to form a record company. And then again, I joined them in 1967 to stay.
Did you have to audition to get in?
No. I guess the word is con my way into the orchestra. When I got in there as a trombone player, they were very short of musicians because the business was so good. Everybody who was a soloist could have his own band. But later, he needed a road manager. And all his friends had turned him down because they said they wanted to remain his friend. And the last man he could think of was me, so he called me up and said, I want you to be the road manager. I knew what trouble he'd had in trying to find someone. I said, yeah, I'll do it on the proviso that I play trumpet as I do the road manager. So he put me in as a fifth wheel. Actually, I was a fifth wheel. There were five trumpets there at the time.
And that's how you became the road manager, too.
Right.
You ended up being the manager of a band where you knew all the musicians since your childhood. And
which is the worst handicap you can have.
Yeah, because they probably thought of you as the kid, even though you weren't the kid anymore.
And it wasn't that so much. It was just one of those things. They thought of me as the gopher. That was my first job.
So you'd have to run out and get stuff.
For, yeah, and I still have it. I have every job left that I started out with. I still go get the sandwiches. I help with the baggage. I help set up the bandstand. And I have to do the copying and also make arrangements.
So how did you gain respect and a sense of authority when you became the road manager?
Never did get any respect, I guess. You talk about Rodney Dangerfield. It was one of those things where, you know, you just hung in there long enough to be accepted. And I think this is the main thing. We had people who joined the band and quit because they'd come in for weeks and nobody even say good morning to them. There were no two men that hung out with each other in that orchestra except Bonnie Bigard and Ben Webster.
Did you have to worry about disciplining the band members for lateness or for drunkenness or things like that?
You don't discipline a musician for being drunk. I mean, that's part of his creativity. And if you take his inspiration away, it's part of what it takes to be in this business. I was advised by my father to drink because you won't have the inhibition to relax and to even have flowing ideas. I'm not recommending drunkenness. I'm talking about drinking. And so if you're going to drink, one day you're going to have a little bit too much to drink and you will get drunk. But as far as alcohol is concerned, it has constructive purposes. I mean, even now, people advise wine instead of tranquilizers. So I will not admonish or nor did I try to discipline anybody because of alcohol. I had things I had to try to get, instill. That was making time for bus calls and trying to keep the guys from, you know, going too deep into their money because I knew most of them had responsibilities. Not all of them, just a few here and there. But that's the kind of discipline you had to worry about.
As several people have pointed out, I think music wasn't your father's only mistress.
Well, I mean, since you brought it up, I want you to know that when I wrote the theme title for the album, my way of composing it is that each of the themes represents one of the five most important women in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And the one, it's odd and strange that the one that you picked to play represented one of the most congenial and most beautiful and wonderful ladies of all. Her name was Evie. And it was that she was a very serious lady, and she's a lady he spent really the majority of his life with. He had paramours, you know, but for the most part, she represented his real love. And he, from time to time, would take an excursion, but he always returned home.
How did you feel about your father having paramours? Were you comfortable with that as his son? And did you ever get close to any of the women who your father was in love with?
Well, I think so, particularly with Evie. Mm-hmm. That's the one we were talking about originally.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what he was concerned, the way I felt about it was this man had done such a marvelous job with himself and for everyone. I can tell you this, that during the course of his lifetime, he took care of an entire family. By that I mean, you know, like people who were cousins, uncles, aunts, and so forth, their businesses had failed. And I felt that with him having done so much for other people to make them happy, he was entitled to the happiness which was important to him.
We're featuring an interview with Mercer Ellington, who died yesterday at the age of 76. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with Mercer Ellington, recorded in 1989, after the release of his album Music Is My Mistress, in which he conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Let's hear a track from that album featuring Mercer's own composition, Danish Eyes. An excerpt of a composition by Mercer Ellington called Danish Eyes. You are, with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, playing some of Ellington's neglected works, some of the extended works, as well as some of his most popular compositions. When you take out a work that hasn't been played in a long time and you're looking at the score, is it difficult to read? And I ask you that because in a memoir that you wrote about your father, Duke Ellington, you say that he frequently wrote really cryptically because he was afraid that people would steal his composition, which was, I guess, pretty common then, that people would steal other people's ideas. So he'd write it so it couldn't be stolen that easily. Are you stuck with having to decipher that now?
No, not really, because I did so much copying that I recognized his symbols and all the little things he did to disguise the music. For instance, one of them would be to write a part and put the wrong clef sign on it. So if somebody had started naming the notes, they'd have it completely messed up. The other thing was to use, you know, this descriptive titling on numbers so that if you heard a number and you wanted to get it out of the book, like, for instance, you know, he'd make an arrangement that would say a new concept of In My Solitude, you'd never find it. If you wanted to say, you know, he did a tune called Squeeze Me. Well, on one occasion, it would be titled Slew Slew. And then another time, he called it Subtle Slough. So if you looked in the in the music to try to, say, take the parts out and copy them over or get some kind of idea of what was happening, you couldn't recognize the tune by the writing that was on it. Well, because the saxophones had one name on it and the trombones had another, and you could never really piece them together.
So how common was stealing through sheet music?
Well, in the days, I mean, it was very blatant at one point. And even in the old Cotton Club days, the guys from downtown would come in with their pencils in their hands and just blatantly sit there with the music and sit in the front row copying down what they heard.
It's amazing. In Music Is My Mistress, your father's collection of memoirs and reminiscences about musicians, he wrote a couple of pages about you, and he started it by saying, "My son, Mercer Ellington, is dedicated to maintaining the luster of his father's image." Did you ever feel that he perhaps took that for granted?
No, but what he's doing, in essence, he was saying something in print that he could never say to me individually. And it was not necessarily meant for the reader as much as it was meant for me, because he had the difficulty of being able to talk intimately to me. I have the same difficulty. If I had to say to my wife or my children or something else that they did something I liked, I'd find it difficult to make the statement. I think this was his way of expressing approval of what of many of the things I had done, or saying thanks for having done it.
Did he spend a lot of time with you? I know when you were growing up, your parents separated when you were pretty young. You divided your time between each of their houses. Did you get to see him much? Were you close?
Oh, yeah. And in those days, I spent 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
As far as my time was concerned, one half of the year with my mother, or, you know, 2 weeks here and 2 weeks there and so forth. And I got the value of two worlds, and each was very important. I got the value of living, as they would say, high on the hog, because I'd be around Pop and the important people that he knew, and a lot of the, you know, great stars in show business, Fats Waller, Art Tatum, and so forth. And with my mother, we lived an average, everyday existence. No one knew who I was. I was just somebody else on the street. And I got to know how that kind of a person lived, and I never got to a place where I felt I rose above that, that I was not, you know, someone who was highly privileged and could afford to ignore the feelings or the way anyone else felt. So I think for that reason, the way I raised was, in a sense, a rich possession to have.
In a memoir that you wrote about your father, you said that he really wasn't prepared to have children when you were born, and if he was going to have a child, he probably would have preferred a girl, so that when you were raised to please your father, you had to wear these long braids.
We used to call them plaits.
What I couldn't figure out was whether that was something you remembered or something you were told later by your family.
Well, my mother's the one that told me.
How did you feel about it when you found out?
It didn't make any difference to me.
Oh, okay.
I was glad that I was a boy. I'm glad he didn't get his wish.
Do you have any of your father's show business superstitions? He had a lot of superstitions, didn't
he? Oh, he's gotten us all, you know, in a place where we've been brainwashed. And when it gets down to it, there were only two colors which he really, you know, allowed, and that was blue and white. And then once in a while, he allowed a little red to come in. I guess maybe that had to do with his patriotism. But you dare not whistle in the dressing room, nor bring in a newspaper, nor peanuts. And he hated green. Green was always bad luck to him.
Where do these things come from? Do you have any idea?
Well, it came related to experiences. He hated green and he hated brown because he was wearing a brown suit the day his mother died.
Oh.
And so he had a reason behind it, an experience to relate to.
So would you wear brown now?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
I wear green. He, however, did not object to green on the back of dollar bills.
Since so many people know you as the son of Duke Ellington, are people surprised when they find out that you're getting older yourself? You were born in 1919. Do you know what I mean? I think in a lot of people's eyes, you're going to be just perpetually very young.
Ellington has caused a tremendous oversight on my age for quite a while. In the old days, he used to say he didn't want anyone to know he had a son with gray hair because it might keep the chicks away. And then he's still at it even as of now because I told people, and we had quite a do, you know, in this past month, celebrating his 90th birthday. And so they all got to where, we got around and took care of each other and everything like that. And all of a sudden they said something about, well, you shouldn't be tired. I explained to them, I said, you've all been so busy celebrating Duke Ellington's 90th birthday that you've forgotten that I'm on my 70th. And I'd like to get some sleep for a change.
Mercer Ellington, I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for joining us on Fresh
Air. It's been very pleasant, Terry.
Mercer Ellington died yesterday of heart failure at the age of 76. Our interview was recorded in 1989. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
DeGeneres and Bill Pullman star in a new movie comedy about a woman who thinks she meets Mr. Right but finds out he's Mr. Wrong. Coming up, interviews from the archives with DeGeneres and Pullman. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new action film Broken Arrow, starring John Travolta. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Coming up from the archives, interviews with the two stars of the film comedy Mr. Wrong, which opens next weekend. Ellen DeGeneres plays a TV talent coordinator who's in her 30s, single, and under pressure to find a mate. Enter Whitman Crawford, played by Bill Pullman. He's handsome, rich, and smart, and he is literally too good to be true. But by the time she realizes that he's Mr. Wrong, he's too obsessed to give her up. In this scene, she tries to break off the romance.
Whitman, you are... you're an incredible person. I mean, you're really something else, you know? And I've really... mostly enjoyed the time that we've spent together. But sometimes it's about chemistry, you know? And sometimes chemistry works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you get an explosion or a really bad smell. You know what I mean? Not good. Okay, you know how you feel about Inga? You know how she still loves you, but you don't love her? How you used to love her, but you don't love her anymore? How? Okay, look, here's good. This is good. I am salt, and you are pepper. All right? Okay? Now, salt and pepper goes together, right? Sometimes. You know, but some, it doesn't have to. You don't have to have pepper with salt. Sometimes salt goes alone. Sometimes salt goes with other herbs, even. And I'm saying that I want to see other herbs.
Ellen DeGeneres is best known as the star of the sitcom Ellen. She plays a bookstore owner named Ellen, who's in her 30s, single, with the requisite number of neurotic and annoying friends. Like so many hit sitcoms, Ellen is built around an actor who started off as a stand-up comic. And like several comics-turned-actors, she has a best-selling book. I spoke with her when it was published last September, and she told me how she started her career as a stand-up comic.
The first time was in New Orleans, and it was probably 81, something like 1981, in New Orleans for a benefit, some people trying to raise some money for some legal function. I don't know what it was, and they didn't have any access to talent or anything, and they just were just putting stuff on stage. Someone had a band, and someone else probably made balloon animals. I don't even remember at this point. And they asked me to get up on stage because I had always been funny around them, and they thought, well, just get up on stage and be funny. And at this time, I guess Steve Martin was doing comedy, and you know, there was comedy, but it wasn't nearly like it was in the last 10 years. And I didn't know what to do. I got on stage and I ate, this is when I was eating red meat. I ate a Whopper, fries, and a shake. And I basically said that I didn't have time to eat all day because I was so nervous because this was my first time on stage. So if you don't mind, I just need to eat really quickly. And I tried to get a sentence out. You know how people start when you're like having lunch with them and they start to tell you something and then they take a huge bite and then they hold their finger up like you just 1 second while they swallow. And it's like, why did you even start the sentence if you're going to take a bite? And then they start the sentence again and then they take a sip or they take another. And so I did that on stage for as long as it took me to eat a Whopper, fries, and a shake. And I didn't say anything the whole time. And then I looked at my watch and said, my time's up. Thank you. Good night. And that was what I did on stage the first time.
How'd it go over?
It was, I don't remember. I mean, I just
kind of... You're too busy eating.
I ate the whole time. I don't know. It was good enough that someone who booked a college in New Orleans saw me and asked if I would go on stage and do something there. And I decided I should stop eating because this really would not be a good career to eat on stage all the time. And unless you're like just performing once a month. So I started writing material, and I'm sure some of it was really, really bad. But at the time, it was, you know, just like bell bottoms were popular at one time. Maybe the material will come back again. Bell bottoms have. So, I just kept writing material, and it just kind of fell into my lap.
What was the circuit that you played early on?
Clubs or restaurants sometimes. You know, comedy got to be, it replaced the mechanical bull. So, you know, it was like whatever was going to make somebody money, they put it in wherever you could fit it. I mean, I really thought that at some point Macy's was going to have like a little section where you could just go watch comedy before you buy shoes. Wherever you can make money, people will do it. So here are these guys that have no idea what comedy is, what art is. You know, they have a pizza parlor and they decide, you know, yeah, we'll get a couple of comedians in here and we'll fill the place on Tuesday night. And usually it's not filled on Tuesday night. So, you know, and maybe cheese pizza will be, you know, $2. And so I was playing some horrible... I played places that, now I talk about my book, that I actually showed up. We drove from, it was like some guy, I didn't even know who he was. We were just kind of assigned to work together. And we drove to this place, and in front of the restaurant, there's like a chalkboard on the sidewalk, and it says, soup of the day, whatever it was, you know, cream of asparagus, and Ellen DeGeneres. That was, and like, so soup of the day had top billing. I mean, I didn't even rank above the soup. And so people had to really want that soup in order to come in, and then if they wanted to see me, they got to see me as well. And it was like this long, narrow, you know, not, I think the stage was maybe like a couple of cases of beer with a piece of plywood on top. And I had, you know, some kind of horrible microphone that kept feeding back the whole, ooh, every other word you couldn't hear. It was horrible.
Now, who taught you the facts of life?
Nobody. That's why I try in my book to teach you how to explain sex to your child, because nobody taught me. And as you read in my book, I still don't know how to teach anybody. It's just sort of a kind of spirals out of control. But nobody did. I think I remember hearing girls talk about it in a bathroom. And it was kind of late. I was a late bloomer for everything. I was in seventh grade when I heard about it for the first time, what happens.
How'd you hear about it?
In the bathroom. I heard girls, you know, talking about it. And
did you believe it?
Well, I asked my mother how long it has to stay in. She was shocked by that question. I mean, it was, to me, it the way it was described, it sounded like, you know, going to a gas station and putting the pump into the gas tank, and just leave it there until the tank is full, and then you remove it and you pay the cashier. That's exactly what I pictured. I really just thought, well, wow, that's a shame that has to happen. And so no one really, I mean, I remember asking my mother that question, like, how long does it have to stay in? And I think she said, not very long. And then that was it. That was our whole discussion of the mother-daughter talk.
Ellen DeGeneres stars in Mr. Wrong, which opens next weekend. Coming up, an interview with her co-star, Bill Pullman. This is Fresh Air. Bill Pullman plays Mr. Wrong in the new film comedy. He was married to Mrs. Wrong in the erotic thriller The Last Seduction. He played the father in Casper and the romantic lead in the hit comedy While You Were Sleeping. In Sleepless in Seattle, he was Meg Ryan's allergy-plagued fiancé. Last year, we invited Pullman to talk about his movies and his life. Here's a scene from The Last Seduction. He plays a cynical guy who's not quite cynical enough. He's not onto how his wife has set him up. She's literally taken the money and run. In this scene, toward the end of the film, a stranger has broken into his house and is trying to tie him up. The stranger has been sent by Pullman's wife, but Pullman doesn't know that.
Now what?
I'm gonna gag you.
How am I gonna tell you where everything is? Am I yelling? You have a gun. I'm cooperating. Forget the gag.
Gag's important.
Did you read a book on this? You know, kid, you don't look like a dope head.
What?
I just write prescriptions, right? I got no stash. The money goes to a loan shark. I got some aspirin in the medicine cabinet, but other than that, I got nothing here you want.
I'm not interested in your drugs, all right?
You're just breaking in at random? Great. The guy next door is out of town for a month.
Open. Open. Oh. Open.
Did the last seduction put you through a lot of mood changes, mood swings, in the sense that, oh boy, a great script, how exciting. Oh, it's just going to play on HBO and never get released theatrically. What a bummer. Oh, it's getting released theatrically and it's a big cult film now. You know, I mean, it just kept going back and forth between success and failure.
Yeah. And then it here accounts that, like, Linda Fiorentino was in France at screenings and they stood up at the end going, Linda, Linda, you know. I think, man, this was the same movie that we made for, like, I don't know, a couple mil and some warehouse down in Culver City. And, yeah, it was a surprise.
Did anybody stand up and chant, Bill, Bill?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think when you die in a movie, they don't end up kind of like calling for you to come back. But
one of the men are kind of chumps in the film.
Yeah. They, you know, in some realm. But I always thought that, like with Clay, that character, that he was probably the most appropriate man for her to be with. And she kind of, I get this from her performance too, that like there's just this gaming quality that they're like really right for each other. And if I hadn't slapped her at the opening, we would have gone on and just spent the money and had our life there in New York. But I slapped her, and she just suddenly decided, no, I'm going to take it all.
Let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in upstate New York. Your father was a doctor, and I think you had six siblings.
Right. Yeah?
So what was it like to have a father who's a doctor? Did he take care of you when you got sick?
Yeah, he did all of the... I used to have sore throats a lot, so he used to roll me over on the couch and shoot me up with penicillin.
Oh, see, I hated that as a kid. And my doctor used to scare me. He came in, I thought, oh, this guy... I always associated his kind of face with the face of a doctor and with pain, because he always gave me a shot of penicillin.
Did you get it in your rump?
Of course. That's how they gave it to all kids then. No matter what you had, right, you got a shot of penicillin.
I think it was the humiliation of that it was...
Well, it must have been worse getting it from your father than getting it from a doctor who at least left when it was over, right?
Well, you know, it's on the family sofa, and, you know, that way you could just kind of keep lying there. You wouldn't have to get up. But he was always interesting that way, how very supportive of the life that I chose, and I think he kind of had a lot of wisdom in the way he dealt with things, and he was always kind of interested in just in terms of his ego. I guess I've been thinking about this lately because I was thinking, you know, I've kind of, every once in a while somebody would say, well, you're just not your regular guy or somebody, you're not hugely demanding on the sets. You know, I really almost kind of like feel more like a producer when I'm acting than an actor, in that I really want the whole team to do well and I don't need any special attention and everything. So it's somehow egoless, and that sometimes can be also read as dismissible in some ways. Like, if you're going late, does he suffer? No, he's not suffering. Let's keep going. You know? But and I thought, you know, I realized that with my father's, and the whole idea of being in medicine is that you have very little ego and you have a lot of ego. That in some ways you are very kind of attending, and you're in a very service kind of situation to other people, and you're very intricately involved with reading them, understanding them, sensing their pain, sensing their needs. And at the same time, you're making decisions that you have to, like, really be hugely strongly behind. And otherwise, if you live in doubt or hesitancy, you're not going to succeed. And in that way, I think that was kind of the climate of what it was to be a male ego in our household.
I know before you went to college and studied acting, you went to, I think, a two-year technical college to study building construction, is that right?
Right, yeah.
So what were you thinking of doing at the time?
Well, I was kind of in a period where I didn't want to do what my brothers had done, which was go to small Ivy League colleges and everything. And I wanted to do something where I felt like I could... at that point, I was really fascinated by barns. It was, you know, I was 17, I think, and I was just aware of the fact that in my part of Western New York State, there was a lot of agricultural life that was disappearing. And I loved the architecture of barns. And I thought, I'll go to this building construction program and I'll learn about making barns and mix barns. No, it wasn't very practical at all. But once I got there, I realized that instead I was spending hours and hours doing formulas where you figure out how many water closets an office building needs. And I realized, this isn't what I had in mind. Maybe I ought to go into something else. And by that time, I had kind of gotten attracted to this program, this drama program, this guy Bill Campbell in Delhi, New York, was running, and he was very charismatic, and so I started doing theater there.
Now, I know after you studied acting in college, you went to Montana and taught at the University of Montana, ended up...
It was Montana State University, yeah, in
Bozeman. Okay, thank you. And then ended up teaching there, and then finally, I think, chairing the drama department. Was it hard for you to teach with so little experience at the time?
It was a big charade. The best acting I ever did in my life. I even had a corduroy coat with patches on my elbows. That's how insecure I was. Oh, man, I was just a couple years older than anybody there. And I hadn't planned to teach. I planned to go to New York and work as a professional because I knew that I thought, you know, teachers should have had practical life experience. And then Montana's so beautiful, and I'd been out there for a bunch of years before doing open-air theater, and I liked all these people involved with this program, and I said, all right, I'll do it. And I did it for 1 year thinking that that'll be it. And then they said, oh, stay, And so I stayed a second year, but by the middle of the second year, I knew I had to kind of just say, whew, I pulled this off and nobody's really turned on the lights, so I might as well get out while the going's good.
And you went where, to New York?
Yeah, went to New York City.
And started acting in theater?
Yeah, I once...
let me ask you, when you started doing auditions and they said, well, what's your experience? And you said, well, I taught acting in Montana. Was that considered an important credential?
No, I never told anybody. I never told them I trained as a director. I kind of, even in a way, because that was my training, was as a director in theater, for theater directing. And you're living on practically air. I had no money, and I was doing survival jobs for like $3.50 an hour. So it felt rather sad to say, I was just a college professor last year. Right, yeah.
Now, Ruthless People was your first film, and I think your first comedy as well. Was comedy unlike what you were used to? Is it really was a big change for you?
Yeah, that was a very... It was a surprise because I had... I kind of made my way around New York City with parts that were... like a very kind of physical, troubled dramas and the other things that made me very surprised that I was going to do this big Hollywood comedy. And later, I look back on it, I thought, you know, that Ruthless People is actually one of the few comedies that are rated R. So that was a pretty racy comedy, you know. But at the time, it felt like selling out a little bit. But it was a surprise. And then since then, I have kind of really enjoyed a lot of these comedies. So it feels like a very natural kind of extension of what I'm interested in. But I have to say, the best funny to me is funnies that come out of a movie like Last Seduction.
Yeah, right.
There's something about, I know those are the movies I laugh most at, is when it feels like you aren't trying to make a comedy, and it's somehow, it's very serious, but it's also very funny.
Yeah, I agree. Now you have another movie coming up soon called Mr. Wrong, which stars you and Ellen DeGeneres. Can you give us a preview?
Well, I'm very fond of this whole character and the story and everything. It's a black comedy. That's one of the reasons why I was thinking about Ruthless People, because they were trying to justify the fact that there can be some tough, weird, dangerous zones you can go to in a comedy and maybe get an R and still make some money and not have everybody fear that they're going to just be in a clunker or something. But it's Ellen is a woman who's not with a guy, and there's a lot of pressure on her to find somebody, and we meet each other, and I'm a very right kind of guy, and it feels like the most romantic of the romantic encounters you could ever imagine. She goes a little far, she goes a little too early, but I'm sure it's happened, but all of us, but that, and then that feeling the next day, is this for real? I think it's for real. I think it's a dream. It's great. And then in the slowest incrementations, this character, Whitman, you realize is not exactly what she had in mind, but he's very obsessively in love with her, and he's pursuing her. And some say that he becomes, just the thing you want to avoid and get away from. It's like it's a nightmare. It's the monster. But I like to think of Whitman as culturally unintegrated. He's marching to his own drummer. He's never a threat to her, but he just has his own passions and his own inclinations, which when he decides to really allow the world to see the way he really feels, it's a little scary.
Well, that sounds great. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks. It was a great privilege to be on the show that I listen to so much.
Bill Pullman recorded last summer. He stars in the new comedy Mr. Wrong, which opens next weekend. Coming up, a review of the new film Broken Arrow. This is Fresh Air. Director John Woo was known to connoisseurs of Hong Kong action movies for years before he came to the United States. In fact, in Hong Kong, he made 26 features, including the cult hits The Killer in 1989 and Hard Boiled in 1991. In 92, he went Hollywood with the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Hard Target. And his new movie stars no less than John Travolta. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Broken Arrow.
Action movies come in two flavors: grim and gripping, like The Fugitive and In the Line of Fire, and funny and over the top, like the James Bond movies and the Die Hard movies and the Beverly Hills Cop movies. But John Woo's action pictures fall between the cracks. They're certainly funny and over the top, but you can never escape the feeling that Woo himself takes everything in them very, very seriously. Broken Arrow is about two macho stealth bomber pilots. The good one, played by Christian Slater, is raw and green and unsure of himself. The bad one, played by John Travolta, is a super-confident nutcase. He and Slater have been ordered to take the stealth out for a test drive fully loaded with two nuclear weapons. Somehow or other, Travolta has planned for the occasion. He and the gang he's gathered want to kill Slater, crash the bomber, steal the nukes, and then force the U.S. government to pay an enormous ransom for them. The screenplay is by Graham Yost, who wrote Speed, and it's fairly lame and formulaic. Yost has even added a Sandra Bullock-like love interest in the person of Samantha Mathis, who plays the park ranger tagging along with Slater as he attempts to defeat Travolta. Mathis and Slater are proficient, but they're not whom you've come to see. You've come to see Travolta give his first performance as an outright villain, and he doesn't disappoint. In fact, he seems to be having the time of his life, as in this scene, in which he confronts the chief financier of his nefarious plan, a certain Mr. Pritchett, played by Bob Gunton.
I do appreciate the money that you and your associates have invested in this operation, but it is an operation. It's a military operation. Now, I haven't been in the military for 20 years. I planned and flew over 100 missions in the Gulf. I put these boys together because they are motivated and they are highly trained like me. This is what I do, Mr. Pritchett, and this is battle. And battle is a highly fluid situation. You plan on your contingencies, and I have. You keep your initiative, and I will. But what you don't do is share command. It's never a good idea.
Still my money.
And if we succeed, you and your friends will get a ton of it.
If we're successful.
Look, Mr. Pritchett, I will deliver the weapons to the destination. But I can't depend, and I can't guarantee pay.
What if they don't?
Well, if they don't, the Southwest will be a quiet neighborhood for about 10,000 years.
All through that scene, Travolta makes a great show of talking through clenched teeth like a bad ventriloquist, caressing his under chin like Marlon Brando in The Godfather, and smoking a cigarette with as much high style as Betty Davis. In fact, high style is what Travolta's all about. The catalog of cool that he's been compiling since the days of Saturday Night Fever is now almost as detailed as the catalog of female sex appeal that Marilyn Monroe contrived in the 50s. On screen, both of them are fascinatingly artificial, but they can also appear suddenly real amid all the affectation. One second we're distanced by their style, and the next we're brought in close by their vulnerability. Travolta plays most of Broken Arrow way over the top, but whenever he's on screen, you can't take your eyes off him. And when he's not, John Woo is playing the action sequences way over the top, too. They're choreographed and patterned in a way that makes you laugh out loud. The movie stops dead now and again as Woo gets all serious over the meaning of friendship, the will to win, and other profound action movie concerns. But fortunately, the ponderous stuff never lasts long. Broken Arrow offers no real moral lessons and no meaning worth contemplating. It's just plain dumb fun.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolfe. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Primary Colors, a novel of politics by Anonymous. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.